Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
Two women have entered a Hindu temple for the first time since a ban was lifted on female visitors between the ages of 10 and 50. The women entered the Sabarimala temple in the southern state of Kerala on Wednesday. The move led to large protests across the state. The long-time ban barred women or girls of menstruating age from entering the temple, which draws millions of visitors each year. Some Hindus consider menstruating women to be impure. India's Supreme Court ordered a lifting of the ban in September. But despite the ruling, opponents and conservatives continued to block women aged 10 to 50 from entering. A local police spokesperson said officers walked with the two women Wednesday to provide protection during their visit. The Reuters News Service reported that a police official said officers also guarded the homes of the women after they left the temple. Police were also prepared to go with other women who wanted to enter the temple, the official said. Protests broke out in several places in Kerala state after the women entered the temple. The police spokesperson said demonstrators blocked several roads and threw rocks at officers. He added that police fired tear gas in an effort to stop violence. There were no immediate reports of injuries. Police officials said they were preparing for more demonstrations on Thursday because several political and Hindu groups have called for a strike to protest the women's entry. On Tuesday, millions of women in Kerala joined hands to form a human link that stretched more than 600 kilometers. The act was a showing of support of gender equality. The Communist Party of India, the ruling party in Kerala state, said about 5.5 million women took part. On Wednesday, hundreds of women in Mumbai, India's financial capital, also formed a human chain to express support for the women in Kerala. The Supreme Court has agreed to re-examine its decision to lift the ban after numerous legal challenges were brought against it. Opponents of the ruling have argued that decisions made by the temple's religious leaders are protected by India's constitution. They also note that women of all ages can worship at other Hindu temples. The Kerala state government has sought to permit women to enter the Sabarimala temple. But the position has drawn criticism from other political parties. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP party opposes the Supreme Court's decision. Modi told India's ANI news service that he felt the temple issue was more about religious tradition than gender equality. He noted that there are also temples that bar men from entering. I'm Anna Mateo.
3-day-old Oscar Lunda sleeps in a small bed at an Estonian hospital. Across the room, his father turns on a laptop computer. "Now we will register our child," Andreas Lunda says, as he lifts his identification card into the card reader. His wife, Olga, looks on. And just like that, Oscar is Estonia's newest citizen. No paper, no time spent standing in a line. Estonia has launched a project to make government administration completely digital. The goal is to reduce the size of the government workforce, open up the decision-making process, and fuel economic growth. As more countries turn to online government services, Estonia's experiment provides a look at how interacting with the state might be for future generations. Need medicine? Reach for a computer and send an email or text message to a doctor. Need help from the local government? There are no lines on websites. As for education, parents can see whether their children's homework was done on time. Estonia has created a single system that supports electronic authentication and digital signatures. It provides paperless communications for both the government and private industry. There are a few things that one cannot do electronically in Estonia: marry, end a marriage, or buy and sell property. That is only because the government has decided it was important to show up in person for some big life events. This spring, the government aims to take additional steps. If Oscar had been born a few months later, he would have been registered electronically, with his parents receiving an email welcoming him into the nation. Martin Kevats is Estonia's national digital advisor. He says the goal is a government that supports its citizens while staying out of the way. "Other countries have a lot to learn," says Siva Vidhinathan. He is director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. "Estonia took time to build security and privacy into its online model. It made sure that state accountability is part of the process," Vidhinathan said. Estonians largely seem to have welcomed the new system, while people in other countries are more concerned about attacks on computers. At a demonstration of the digital system, project manager Indrek Onik stood beside a large picture of his computer profile. It showed his high school records from 10 years ago and driving record. If he had a dog, its vaccination record also would appear there. Citizens can follow their personal data and see if any government or private organization looks at it. The system is supported by a software program called X-Road, a data exchange system that links computer databases. Outgoing records are digitally signed and recorded, and all incoming data is confirmed and noted. When Estonia declared independence from the former Soviet Union in 1991, it had to build a new economy. Government leaders looked for an industry where the country could compete. They decided on information technology and the internet. When the poor country needed to replace a 1930s phone system, former President Thomas Hendrik Ilves rejected the offer of a free analog system from Finland and argued for a digital one. The only way we could do really well was to go digital, Ilves told the Associated Press. The project, which began in 1997, led the way for Estonia's technology industry. The government built computer labs for young students in schools. And Microsoft bought Estonia's most famous high-tech export, the video calling service Skype, for $8.5 billion in 2011. Last year, information and communications accounted for 5.9% of the economy. The government hopes to increase that figure with an e-residency program that lets entrepreneurs around the world register their businesses in Estonia and gain a presence in the European Union. More than 51,000 people from 167 countries have registered at a cost of 100 euros, or $114 each. The government also has a plan to re-establish digital services in the event of invasion or severe cyber attacks. The plan would set up what are being called data embassies in other countries like Luxembourg. Like a traditional embassy, the servers are considered Estonian territory and would give the government a chance to set up somewhere else, if needed. Zvika Krieger is head of technology policy and partnerships at the World Economic Forum. He wonders if Estonia's system can be used in countries like the United States and India, with more people and more governments at the city, state, and local levels. Krieger said, "Estonia is a good first test case, and now the question is whether other countries will find Estonia's success compelling enough to take the risk to try it at a larger scale." Estonia sees its system as a design for modern democracy as compared to authoritarian use of technology to control citizens. Ilves, the former president, said, "Estonians hate their politicians just as much as everyone else. But at least since the administration of the state works extremely well and efficiently, people trust the system." Andreas Lunda is among those who trust the system. He says digital government makes life so much easier that it is worth the risk. He points out that personal information can be stolen from paper-based systems as well. "If someone really wants my information, they will get it anyway," said Lunda. "If they can get Hillary's emails, they can get mine." I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Andrew Jackson was nearing the end of his presidency. He had served two terms. For many Americans, Jackson remained incredibly popular. They liked that a poor boy from the frontier, who could barely read and write, grew up to become president. Historian Daniel Feller is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He calls the president and war hero the ultimate American self-made man.
He's a quintessentially American figure. You can't imagine anybody like this getting to be the head of a country at that time, certainly anywhere else but in the United States. And even in the United States, it would have been unheard of just a few years before.
Daniel Feller says Jackson often used government to help ordinary people instead of the rich and powerful. For this reason, many called him the people's president. But not everyone agreed. His opponents said, "Tyrants have always spoken in the name of the people." They said Jackson used his popularity to do whatever he wanted, whether it was legal or not. His opponents in Congress even denounced him with a censure resolution for not releasing some of his papers to the government. They called him King Andrew. Many American Indians called Jackson yet another name. They called him Jackson the Devil. Jackson wanted Native Americans in southern states, including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, to move west. Jackson did not think it was right for Indian tribes to exist as independent nations within the United States. And white voters wanted Indians' land for farming. Historian Daniel Feller points out that the United States government had tried to get Indians to move away from white settlements for a long time, long before Jackson became president.
But Jackson brought an urgency to it that none of his predecessors had. Quincy Adams and Monroe had endeavored to remove Indians when Indians seemed to be willing to be removed. Jackson took the position that they need to be removed now.
In 1830, Jackson pushed a bill through Congress called the Indian Removal Act. The bill allowed him to create new Indian homelands in the Oklahoma Territory, an area west of the Mississippi River where few white Americans lived at the time. The federal government would essentially trade the Indians their old land for the new land and pay for tribes to move west permanently.
He managed to convince himself, and I think that's the best way to put it, that he was actually doing the Indians a favor, that Indian tribes that remained in proximity to whites simply disintegrated. Their tribal structure, their national structure disintegrated. They died.
Daniel Feller says just because Jackson believed he was helping the Indians did not mean he did not benefit from their removal or that he was right. Besides, the Indians did not have much choice. Jackson told them that if they did not accept his offer, their nations would be controlled by the American government. The Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creeks agreed under pressure. The Cherokees resisted. They even took their case to the Supreme Court, which agreed that the Indians were independent from state authority. But Jackson and the state of Georgia ignored the Supreme Court's decision. Eventually, soldiers forced the Cherokees from their homes and marched them over 1,600 kilometers to Oklahoma. More than 5,000 died. The forced march later became known as the Trail of Tears. Even the Indians who survived continued to suffer. The United States government did not meet the terms of the treaty. Few Indians were paid for their goods. Most were not given food and other supplies during the journey or when they arrived in Oklahoma. Daniel Feller notes that the United States has a long history of defaulting on its treaties with Indian nations, both before and after Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson might not have intended for the Indians to suffer so much, but he did not lead his government to respect and protect them either.
There are are many who regard Jackson as being the kind of epitome, the exemplar, the personification of everything that has been wrong, not only regrettable, but perhaps evil, in white America's treatment of the Indians.
Daniel Feller says Jackson's treatment of the Native Americans, along with some of his other actions, complicates his image as an American hero.
If you look at Jackson's own personal rise, it's a pretty impressive rise. It leaves a lot of dead people and a lot of displaced or abused populations behind it, including Indians, including slaves, including personally the people he shot. So, again, it's a complicated image. It shows this American character in both, you might say, its best and its most disturbing light at the same time.
In 1836, the American public voted for their next president. Andrew Jackson had served for 8 years. He did not want another term. He supported his vice president, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren had been very close to the outgoing president. In the election of 1828, Van Buren had been successful in forming a strong political alliance. This alliance helped put Jackson in the White House. Jackson was grateful for Van Buren's help and asked him to come to Washington to serve as Secretary of State. Van Buren quickly became the most powerful man in Jackson's cabinet. He was able to help Jackson in negotiations with Britain and France. But his greatest help was in building a strong political party for Jackson. Van Buren built up the Democratic Party by removing people from government jobs if they had not supported Jackson. These jobs were then given to those who had supported the president. Ultimately, it was the Democratic Party that gave Jackson wide support for his policies. Van Buren served as Jackson's Secretary of State for 2 years. By this time, Jackson had decided that Van Buren would be the best man to follow him as president. Jackson offered to resign after the 1832 elections and give Van Buren the job of president. Van Buren rejected the offer. He said he wanted to be elected by the people, but he agreed to be Jackson's vice president in 1832. 4 years later, at Jackson's request, the Democrats chose Van Buren to be their presidential candidate. Several candidates from the newly formed Whig Party opposed him, but the Whigs were divided, and Van Buren easily won the election. March 4, 1837 was a bright, cold day. The winter sun shone over the crowd that had gathered in Washington to watch the swearing-in of the new president. Andrew Jackson left the White House in the presidential carriage, riding beside Martin Van Buren. It was the first time a president and a president-elect rode to the Capitol together for the inauguration. The big crowd on the east side of the Capitol grew quiet when Jackson and Van Buren walked up the steps of the building. After Chief Justice Roger Taney swore in President Van Buren, the new president gave his inaugural speech. Then Andrew Jackson
started slowly down the steps. A mighty cheer burst from the crowd. "For once," wrote Senator Thomas Hart Benton, an ally of Jackson, "the rising sun was eclipsed by the setting sun." The day after Van Buren became president, Jackson met with a few of his friends. Frank Blair, the editor of Jackson's newspaper, was one of them. Senator Benton was another. It was a warm, friendly meeting. They thought back over Jackson's years in the White House and talked about what had been done. Jackson said he thought his best piece of work was getting rid of the Bank of the United States. He said he had saved the people from a monopoly of a few rich men. Someone asked about Texas. Jackson said he was not worried about Texas. That problem would solve itself, he said. Did he have any regrets about anything? "Only two," said Jackson. "I regret I was unable to shoot Henry Clay or to hang John C. Calhoun." The next morning, March 6th, Jackson left Washington to return to his home in Tennessee. Jackson was to leave the Capitol by train. Thousands of people lined the streets to the train station, waiting for a last look at their president. Jackson stood in the open air on the rear platform of the train. His hat was off, and the wind blew through his long white hair. The locomotive bell rang, there was a hiss of steam, and the train began to move. Jackson bowed. One man who was there said it was as if a bright star had gone out of the sky. Jackson lived for 8 more years. He read as many as 20 different newspapers, exchanged letters with many people in government, and spent time with his son and grandchildren. But Jackson's health had never been very good. He had been shot many years before, and the gunshot wounds created problems. Andrew Jackson died at home on June 8, 1845. He was 78 years old. Back in Washington, Martin Van Buren continued Jackson's legacy by carrying out many of his policies. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.